Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is edition 212. On the program today, I am going to be featuring a conversation that I had with Garth Mullins. Garth is the host and executive producer of Crackdown, which is a podcast that looks at the experiences and community organizing of drug users in the context of Vancouver. Crackdown podcast, I think, is a really important window into the ways that community organizing happens at a grassroots level. And most importantly, on this particular front, looks at how the voice of community activists and organizers and drug users who are engaged with dealing with the daily realities, both of state and police repression, but also of finding safe alternatives to a context where the criminalization of drugs and drug users still defines so much of state policy. I'm going to let the conversation we had speak for itself. It was great to speak with Garth, and I'm sharing now the conversation we had on Free City Radio. So Garth, you're a longtime community media maker, also activist in Vancouver. I was there recently and I joined a demonstration that was looking at the realities of the downtown east side, I mean, but particularly safe access. There had been a police raid on a project in the neighborhood that was trying to provide safe access to drugs. And there was a number of organizations present. And I know also you've done some media work to sort of explore in depth these issues. So maybe first of all, you could just introduce yourself and sort of locate a bit your work.
My name's Garth Mullins, and I'm a longstanding member of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. I serve on its board, and I also make the Crackdown podcast, which is about the drug war here in Vancouver. I make it with a really great group of people. And I do this work because I believe in social justice. I've been an organizer for a long time, but also I've been an opioid user for most of my life. I managed to get on methadone at the right time for me, and that really helped me out a lot, probably why I'm alive. And so I want that opportunity for everybody else. That's why I fight for safe supply. That's why I was one of the co-founders of the Drug User Liberation Front, which was subject to police raids and arrests a couple months ago.
Maybe you could locate this moment. We're at the end of 2023. You mentioned this raid, but also there's the broader context of Vancouver. There'll be people listening who are not as familiar with the Vancouver dynamics, the neighborhood. So maybe you could locate this recent event in sort of the context of Vancouver over the last few years.
Sure. I mean, Vancouver is the epicenter for a huge overdose crisis, which is sweeping Canada, well, North America. And, you know, we're in our seventh or almost eighth year of this right now, since it's been a declared public health emergency. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a growing backlash to harm reduction. So the only sort of set of policy solutions that are going to get us out of this, that have barely been tried, that have been subject to a few experiments, but never really rolled out in a major way. Now across Canada, there's a big backlash to them, led by people like Pierre Poilievre, who's the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, but also here locally. Late last year, we saw the election of a mayor and a party who was basically running on more cops. That was their platform. So everywhere you go in Canada right now, you can see this sort of law and order backlash that's scapegoating drug users and looking to get rid of any kind of safe supply or harm reduction approaches and replace them with, I don't know, like involuntary treatment or lock them up approaches or something like that.
So this current situation isn't happening in a historical vacuum. We saw the violence of the quote-unquote drug war in the 1980s. The context was different in the U.S., but obviously those events have been analyzed and looked at critically, and the amount of harm that was caused throughout that period due to those policies has been made quite clear today. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe contextualize what's happening now and how it's important to consider past events also.
Sure. The Canadian drug war really goes way back, and I trace it to 1907. That's when it really went national. Of course, there was prohibition laws right from the beginning of Canada encoded into the Indian Act that applied to Indigenous people that prohibited them from using any substance. But in 1907, there was, racist politics were sweeping Canada in a big way. I mean, they've always been part of Canadian politics, but it was right at the forefront, sort of like a paranoia about Chinese immigration and Japanese immigration and jobs and all that stuff and the moral decay of the white race and all this. So there was a big riot out here, a white riot where white Vancouverites smashed up Chinatown, smashed up Japantown, or tried to. And eventually the Canadian government, out of embarrassment, sent out a high-ranking bureaucrat to give some money to the shopkeepers who got their windows smashed, basically the Chinatown shopkeepers. And when he was out here doing this, he realized there was opium manufacture going on. He wrote back a report to Ottawa saying white women and girls are imperiled. And very quickly, Ottawa passed the Opium Act in 1908. And then came the first drug arrests under that act that same year. And ever since that year, 1908, the laws have gotten thicker and fuller and included more substances. And at some points in our history, we have punished drug users harder than they did in the U.S. So Canada has a drug war of its own, founded in racism, continues to act as a plank of white supremacy. That's why we're seeing so many deaths now today, because substances are illegal, thus they're unregulated, and thus they're sort of, it's a Wild West market out there where anything goes.
This historical link that you highlighted in connecting violent approach in terms of the government attacking drug users and how that's connected to other systems of violence. You mentioned systemic racism back in the early 20th century. Could you draw out those connections? You've mentioned some very profound and important events, but could you draw out a little bit more your analysis about these issues? And because it is quite far outside of the mainstream discussion, even liberal discussions about this issue. Thank you.
Sure. Wherever there's a war on drugs, it's tended to be as a way to attack certain groups of racialized people. So it started here as a way to scapegoat and attack a Chinese residence in Vancouver and British Columbia. And certainly it's been used all over North America for many decades to attack black communities and use it as an excuse really for police to have bigger and bigger budgets to buy sort of paramilitary equipment and to act as a occupying force in black and indigenous communities. And in Canada, indigenous people face disproportionately high rates of stop and search, carding, arrest, incarceration, and death from overdose in the drug war. So all of the effects of prohibition are falling harder on racialized groups of people.
And so when we think about current events, can you connect what's particularly happening right now in Vancouver? There's a lot of displacement. There's a lot of rhetoric that criminalizes the community of the downtown east side and attacks on community initiatives to serve people who are dealing with a lot of the realities that you've described. So maybe if you could try to connect some of this history that you're pointing to and the historical analysis with these present events. I mean, I was at that demonstration. It was very impressive to see people gathered at the intersection of Main and Hastings last month.
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, the coroner finds people dead from overdose all over the city, all over the province, really all over the country, in every neighborhood. The reason why there's a focus on the downtown east side is because there's a housing crisis also. That's the last corner of the city where there's affordable-ish housing. And there's lots of people who are unhoused. And so people are using outside and in a way that they can be observed by passersby or the media. And so there's this idea that drug use is a downtown East Side thing. And it's not. It's all over society. But you have the intersecting crisis of the housing crisis here. You know, the average apartment now rents for something like $2,500 in Vancouver. So, of course, that's the driver of homelessness, is the high price of rent. So you see that people sort of blaming drugs for the housing crisis again. But that's like a nice little shell game. Instead of blaming, developers and the commodification of housing and the people at the top of society, it's very convenient to blame the people at the bottom of society. So there's these, intersecting kinds of, kinds of crises: housing, the drug war, mental health. And so in the context of this backlash that I was talking about earlier, that the right wing is pushing, they're saying that you, the citizen, you're now in danger because there's these homeless drug users running wild in the city and no one's stopping them. But if you elect the right wing, they'll stop them. They'll bring more cops and everything like that. But it turns out that the statistics are often cooked, that really there's not a more dangerous situation for the public now than there has been in the past. In fact, North America is experiencing historic downward trends in crime and violent crime across many decades. So this is really like a moral panic, and I think we've seen them before, but that's how we got to where we are now, is that there's this backlash, this moral panic, and so the police feel that this is a good political environment for them to go and arrest a couple of activists with the Drug User Liberation Front. And that's why we had that demonstration that you were at.
Can you just tell us a bit about the Drug User Liberation Front? Please correct me if I got the name slightly wrong. Could you just describe that event and what this group was doing? Because it was interesting to learn about that. And I think it's also obviously an important initiative.
Sure. The drug user movement, has been demanding safe supply for a long time. We've long understood that people overdose and die because the drug supply is toxic. It's not something about the opioid molecule itself. It's about the fact that you can't predict how strong the flap is that you're going to buy. So you don't know whether you're getting something lethal or something weak. And that's because the market is unregulated. And you also don't know whether other contaminants are going to get included in there, like benzodiazepines or tranquilizers or just garbage, brick dust, industrial detergent, pig dewormer, all kinds of awful things. We've been asking for a safe supply to stop the deaths for a long time. The government, although many studies have shown this is a good idea, it's been tried with prescription heroin in lots of places in the world, including studies in Vancouver, and shown great results. The government really wasn't interested in doing it in any kind of real way. So a bunch of activists got together in 2020 on a Zoom call, and we started the Drug User Liberation Front. And the plan was, we're going to source heroin, meth, and coke. We're going to test it with mass spectrometry. And once we know it's clean and it is what it is, not something else, we're going to give it out to members of drug user organizations. And that's what the group did. And it did it until the fall of this year, 2023, when the police raided the little storefront operation, took all the supply, and arrested two of the principal organizers.
So this initiative happens in a context also that your podcast explores, obviously. Could you just sort of, beyond, it's so important to hear this context and background about the initiative, the community initiative to create a safe supply in the neighborhood, but also the context of police violence. There's a lot of people working and struggling on this issue for a long time, including yourself. Can you maybe just give us a bit of a sense of like the people who are involved in these initiatives and these projects, or if you want to share any sort of personal reflections about the downtown East Side and the beauty of that neighborhood? I mean, every time I get a chance to go to Vancouver, that's one of the few neighborhoods that really still has a spirit, a city spirit. And I mean, just in the sense that you can see that there's a lot of people there who care, who are involved, and it's not just glass condo towers.
Yeah, I mean, in East Van here, the old heads back in the day taught me a code, you know, a code to live by, which is like, you know, you keep six for each other, you don't snitch, you elders and youth are to be protected and respected, you don't rip each other off, like stuff like that, you know. And that sort of code of the street still is alive on the downtown East Side, and people do still try to look out for each other. It's not everybody. There are some assholes there, and like there are everywhere. But there still is a community that tries to hold to those ways. And as the crisis gets worse and worse and more people die, we are losing leaders, and we are losing those people who remember that code in those times, and it's very difficult. But the community has tried to come together in this crisis, I think. And I mean, people work to save each other, right? People have you walk down that street and you're going to run into people every foot who've resuscitated each other, who've brought each other back from overdose. And, you know, that's pretty incredible. And that does build bonds between people. And this is the place where the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users was founded 25 years ago during the last overdose crisis. So there's been one of these before. And I lived and was a drug user through that one as well. So I'm really lucky to be here. But I'm here also because of the fights people before me engaged in, you know, fights for needle exchanges, fights for a safe injection site, fights for more methadone slots, like spaces for people to get on methadone and all that. So those early fights have benefited me. So I just feel an obligation to carry them on for everybody else. And I guess that's the ties of community. That's the ties that that bring us together, you know. But I mean, I don't want to paint it like all over romantic and everything. I mean, it's a place of struggle, and it's also an arena of struggle. Gentrification is closing in on all sides. It's an over-policed neighborhood. You know, it's like people are getting squeezed in every way there. You know, it's become a news desert since the demise of a lot of local papers and media outlets. So yeah, there's lots of things that that are hurting there too.
Well, one, let's pick up on the news desert issue that you've brought up, because you do media work. So maybe talk a bit about your podcast project and why it's important in all this context you've been discussing just now.
Yeah, 5 years ago, we, you know, started Crackdown, and it's a documentary radio series. I think we're into our 42nd episode right now. And we cover the drug war from the perspective of drug users. We started Crackdown because we looked around and saw that representations of drug users in the media were not us. That on the one hand, we were cast as, you know, zombies and scourges on societies by the right-wing press. And by the press in the political center, we were kind of like hapless waifs, you know, that had no control over anything, including ourselves. But the people I knew are activists and organizers and people trying to change the world. And I wanted to show that. You know, I wanted people to see that there is a political aspect going on here, that people are trying to fight back against the conditions of prohibition that are causing so much death and misery. People aren't just taking them lying down. And so we wanted people to see that. Because I think for most people, the concept of a drug user activist sounds surprising, you know, just sounds like something they wouldn't have thought existed. And so we wanted to show that that's a common thing. I mean, to me, it's just like anywhere where people are getting screwed over by government policy or market forces or whatever, anywhere that's happening, you're going to find people fighting back. And the drug war is no different.
So last question, just in terms of like framing, and you mentioned it just now, but obviously this is super important because there is quite a lot of more sympathetic coverage and discussion of the situation of drug use, particularly since the opioid epidemic became so major. But often missing in those conversations is voices of advocacy and voices of clarity from people who are users. And I think like this is sort of a major hurdle that a lot of more liberal conversations have not visited, and sort of thinking about solutions as coming from the ground up. So maybe if you could just talk a bit about the importance of that reframing and how it relates to the work that you do.
Yeah, I mean, the very fact that there's space to have conversations about the overdose crisis and everything that aren't just terrible is because of drug user organizing. Like, we fought for that space with the media. We opened up that space. Any kind of drug policy reform is usually because of drug user organizing. And so many of those policy reforms started in Vancouver because we have the tradition of drug user organizing here, because we've had groups like VanDoo here for 25 years. So, like, needle distribution. Back in the day, we had the highest rates of HIV in the Western world here in Vancouver because authorities were so stingy with needles. They just thought, oh, if they can't get needles, they'll just go home and stop using drugs. Well, what happened is people shared needles and spread HIV. And so people broke the law. Sometimes healthcare workers broke the law and gave out syringes. And that kind of civil disobedience is how we got needle exchanges in Canada. The first one was out here. The same thing is true with supervised consumption sites, as we started the safe injection sites underground illegally out here first. And so it's the same thing with Safe Supply with Dolph. We started that out here first, you know, and I'm hoping that it catches on and changes government policy in the same way eventually. But that's the importance of drug user organizing, is because nothing changes without resistance, without that kind of agitation and solidarity and coalition building.
Garth, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Stefan, and thanks to your listeners. Stay safe and keep six.
That was a conversation with Garth Mullins, who is the host and executive producer of Crackdown Podcast. You can find them at crackdownpod.com. Thanks so much, Garth, for coming on the program today. This has been another edition of Free City Radio, which airs on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Geogeauge, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and now on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. You can find us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just look us up, Free City Radio. Thanks so much for being with us, and we will speak to you soon. Take care.
Files.
Radio.
Exploring feminism and technology through space and time.